The lawsuit has been settled. Those historic names like the Ahwahnee Hotel, Curry Village, and more will be restored. So today on Insight, we'll take you into the national park with an episode of the Cap Radio podcast Yosemite Land from last summer. Then my interview with the award-winning writer Janet Fitch. Her new book, Chimes of a Lost Cathedral, continues the intricate historical fiction that she began with The Revolution of Marina M. You'll hear our conversation recorded last week in Squaw Valley, and Janet will be in Sacramento July 26th at the Clara Auditorium. The hour ends with Gary Vercelli's chat with Grammy-nominated trombonist Wayne Wallace. He performs July 25th at Jazz Night at the Crocker Art Museum in Sacramento. His new record is The Rhythm of Invention. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Because of a lawsuit filed a few years ago, Yosemite National Park had not been able to use some of the historic names that millions of people came to know, the Ahwahnee Hotel, Curry Village, to name a few. The park had been sued by its concessionaire, Delaware North, or DNC, after DNC lost its longtime contract. At issue was ownership of intellectual property, including those historic names. Well, a settlement was reached in mid-July, and those names and the familiar signs are being put back in place. We thought you might enjoy a trip into the park, so here's an episode of the Cap Radio podcast Yosemite Land from the summer of 2018. It begins with Ezra David Romero.
I'm taking you on a walk to one of the most iconic spots in the park, Yosemite Falls. It's this waterfall that cascades down the mountain twice. As you drive in and circle around Yosemite Valley, the falls are hard to miss. And if you do, just follow the line of tourists headed in their direction. You can see Half Dome to the south, El Capitan is around the corner to the north, and the Merced River flows through the center of the valley. But across the street from the Yosemite Falls area is Yosemite Lodge, where a lot of people stay and eat in the park. Nearby, a company that couldn't epitomize corporate America more opened a store earlier this year.
Hello, welcome to Starbucks.
The first Starbucks in the park is now in the Base Camp Eatery at Yosemite Lodge. There's no logo on the outside, but inside it smells and looks just like a Starbucks. I've had a range of emotions about Starbucks opening in the park, but that didn't stop me from ordering.
Can I get a vanilla latte?
What size would you like?
Grande.
Grande.
More than 4 million people visited the park last year. And in 2016, Yosemite hit a record with more than 5 million visitors. The whole idea of a Starbucks in this majestic place made some people really mad.
Grande iced vanilla latte.
More than 27,000 people signed a petition opposing the project that replaced an existing coffee shop. Freddie Brewster started the petition for himself and on behalf of park employees afraid of the repercussions of being vocal on this subject.
This was mainly just a shot across the bow to the Park Service to let them know that people are paying attention to what's going on in our parks.
Freddie used to work for a nonprofit in the park, but now he works for a lodge just outside Yosemite.
It's not necessarily Starbucks or Aramark. It's the Park Service not really upholding its values and not really being a proper caretaker for conservation purposes.
I asked people on my Facebook and Twitter what they thought about Starbucks opening. Robert Pasillas and Christy Page live near Yosemite and visit often.
I was shocked to be in Yosemite Valley and to see Starbucks right there, right dead center. Makes me wonder what's next.
I don't feel that you should drive to Yosemite and say, oh my gosh, I'm gonna go get a latte.
But others weren't so upset. Here's Fresno residents Paul Souza and Jay Center.
Just because Starbucks has a location open on nearly every street corner in America doesn't mean that there will be one on every corner along Northside Drive in Yosemite.
Can't say that I wouldn't mind it, but it does take some of the nostalgia and romance from a historical and beautiful park.
But perhaps Felicia Flick's response best embodied the opinions of those who don't want Starbucks here. She says John Muir would roll in his grave. The Park Service was also cautious about the idea of Starbucks making a home here. Here's Scott Gedeman, who has worked as a ranger in Yosemite for over 20 years.
And I'll be honest, you know, we were skeptical at first as to how is this going to fit in.
You're going to hear from Scott a lot in this series. He's one of the park's public information officers, and I've worked with him for years. And he knows Yosemite very, very well. He says the park had a few requirements for the store, which is operated by Aramark, the park's concessionaire. It's a massive company that provides food services to colleges, stadiums, hospitals, and concert venues.
For example, there's no sign on the outside. We specifically wanted it to have as inobtrusive as possible. That certainly we're not hiding it, but it wasn't appropriate to put a big sign up. And so Aramark was really good about working with us. It was just that original shock that corporate America is coming to a national park.
The company took over things like food, tours, and lodging in 2016. For Aramark, this is an opportunity to upgrade rundown buildings and services that the Park Service couldn't afford to do on its own. Bob Concien with Aramark defended the choice to bring in Starbucks.
Starbucks was selected because they have a very strong environmental platform. They call it their bean to cup platform. It's not an attempt to commercialize the park. It's really an attempt to give the consumers what they're looking for.
The company's revamping all the park's eateries with themes like rock climbing. And honestly, I think they look really good.
Pepperoni pizza for curd. Pepperoni pizza for curd.
At the end of this 15-year contract, Bob says Aramark will have invested $100 million into Yosemite. They also want to improve things like internet and cell phone coverage. Aramark does stand to make a lot of money from this contract, an estimated $2 billion. Scott says the improvements they're making are needed and that corporate America's involvement isn't new for Yosemite.
People don't realize during the early days, there was a hotel on top of Nevada Fall, and they were all businesses, and they all had the equivalent of concession contracts. These quote-unquote commercial services have always been a part of Yosemite.
We're starting Yosemite Land at Starbucks because this obvious new addition to the park feels like commercialization realized. A cherry on top because of how recognizable the brand is. With just a glance, we know what that clear cup and green straw signifies. And for many, it means a slippery slope. But for the Park Service, it equals much-needed improvements to the visitor experience. But what's not obvious is what's happening behind the scenes to improve Yosemite's sense of place. So I had this odd experience as I was leaving Yosemite Lodge and headed to Yosemite Falls. People kept staring at me, and I think it was because I had an iced vanilla latte in my hand. And I think they were just a little surprised that I had a Starbucks. And maybe they wanted one. And some tourists actually asked me, where is Starbucks? So I pointed to the lodge and then they all jetted over there. I felt like I was living a new normal in the park with a Starbucks in my hand. It was here at the start of the trail to Lower Yosemite Falls that I met a woman studying visitors. She's questioning how things like commercialization and cell phones are altering how people experience Yosemite.
So here, as we're walking, we see artists sketching beautiful scenes of
Yosemite Falls.
Yeah, which it took my breath away because it's so spectacular.
Meet Catherine Keske. She's a professor at UC Merced.
Here's something I think is really beautiful. I think an international community and a very large group, and they're, for them, it's posing in front of this majestic wonder, you know, this waterfall. A lot of people, this is probably their first time to Yosemite. Perhaps it'll be the only time that they'll come.
Keske wants to know how the way they're visiting creates memories and how that affects their perception of the park.
We know that there are a lot of crowds in Yosemite, but yet every year we continue to have more and more people. So how does that affect sense of place? Or, to some people, it might be, without crowds, it wouldn't be the same.
The concept of sense of place is all about the reasons why and how people visit and experience places like Yosemite. Keske's research is just starting, but she says understanding sense of place is important because it can help the Park Service learn how people want to use the region.
I'm looking around. There's a family behind us. I see several artists. I see people looking ahead. I haven't seen one person with a frown on their face.
Scott, who we met earlier, says this was the park's original goal with the 1 mile trail at Lower Yosemite Falls. This is an area where the park took an active role in changing how people encounter iconic spots.
It just wasn't a good experience, and so the idea of the Lower Yosemite Fall Project is move the parking away, which allowed us to restore 11 acres, make a 1 mile loop trail, so rather than a photo op, people can walk around handicap accessible, the boardwalks over the wetlands, and it was great, and people have enjoyed it.
So these changes force visitors to experience the falls in a whole new way. Now they have to park far away, walk or take a bus ride to the path, and then walk up a guided trail to the base of the falls. But it's also done something else. The path and its destination have created what I call a selfie trap, where people crowd in at certain spots and they take the same photo. And yeah, I admit, I have photos here too on my phone.
Did you get me photobombing?
So I don't think the Park Service meant to create these selfie traps. Yosemite is just beautiful. It's so hard to not stare up at sites like Yosemite Falls or Half Dome and not raise our phones up, smile, and take a photo. Cara Stella works in a department that develops how guests interact with Yosemite. The idea is to keep people moving while still enjoying. She works in interpretive services. The team intentionally leads visitors along trails with guided hikes and informational signs to give them the most informed experience possible.
Ultimately, visitors will come and have their own value set, and so hopefully we can just be a catalyst for them finding the meaning of this place for themselves.
And a lot of people, including myself, like to show off where we've traveled to and to talk about how a place has changed our lives. UC Merced professor Jeffrey Jenkins says people's reasons for visiting Yosemite are easily seen through social media. He's analyzing maps, old photos, and Instagram and Facebook to document how people's interactions with the park have changed. He wants to analyze my Instagram, so I pull out my phone. Opening my Instagram. This is Double Rainbow I saw on my hike.
A double rainbow. There's another guy that got famous for talking about that on YouTube. Yeah.
You're geospatially contextualizing your story.
Yeah.
You're broadcasting what you've done to the rest of the world.
Jeffrey wants visitors to explore areas beyond the best selfie spots. Places like Tunnel View, Half Dome, and Bridalveil Falls. All these spots are in Yosemite Valley, and around 95% of all visitors never venture out of this part of the park.
There's other iconic spots throughout the Central Sierra here, but either people don't know about them or they're not accessible.
Even though millions of people visit the park every year, there are tons of others who live close to Yosemite that have never been. I grew up very close to the park and now live about 3 hours away, and I meet people every week that have never visited. For many, it's an issue of equity and accessibility. One group in the park has put a lot of thought into who gets to experience Yosemite. I met up with environmental science educator Quat Moretz and a group of Sacramento teens at Mirror Lake in Yosemite Valley. This little lake sits right under the face of Half Dome and is a perfect place to hike in the afternoon. But in the evening, I've been attacked by mosquitoes here.
Stay still. Stay still.
And while we were hiking, we ran into a bear.
It's a bear. Don't get any closer.
The bear was about 10 feet from the trail, and it acted like we weren't even there.
Actually, we're going to back away. Back up. Back up. Give the bear space. It's a huge thing. You got to respect wildlife. We got to keep moving, y'all. Park ranger wants us to.
Quap works for Nature Bridge. It's a nonprofit focused on bringing young people to the park who otherwise may never have an opportunity to come here.
Today, I kind of just learned how awesome y'all are as a group and how much we can get done when a group is focused. We did so much in such little time, right? We went rock scrambling. We went into a cave. We did the blindfolded trust activity through the split rock.
Nature Bridge didn't always focus on creating positive experiences for kids of color in the park. A few years ago, they began focusing on recruiting guides from a variety of sexual orientations and of as many ethnicities as possible. Quap is part Filipino, and the kids on this trip are a mix of Asian, Black, Latino, and white kids.
Students of color and different identities feel more comfortable when they have an educator that looks like them, and it's not what they might stereotypically think an environmental science teacher is going to look like. So they come here and they say, wow, you know, this guy looks like me, this girl looks like me, maybe I could do that job. Rather than thinking, oh, this job is for a certain sect of people in the world.
Quap says he's done a good job if the teens fall in love with nature and in turn become lifelong visitors to Yosemite. The whole point of this podcast is to explore how people's experiences are changing in Yosemite and what that means for the park's identity and its future. We've talked about how the sheer volume of tourists are impacting the park, how commercialization has a major influence here, and how groups are trying to diversify who visits. But another huge issue has to do with the effects of overvisitation on the environment. And the Park Service is actively doing something about that, so iconic spots last for future generations. One of the most visited spots was closed for a couple years because of this. It's a $40 million project funded by the Park Service and the nonprofit, the Yosemite Conservancy.
The day is finally here. Welcome to the dedication ceremony for the Mariposa Grove of Giant Sequoia's restoration project.
That's Scott Gedeman, the ranger that we've heard from throughout the episode. Carrie Klein got that audio for us for Yosemite Land. She's a reporter for Valley Public Radio. Hey, Carrie, take me to Mariposa Grove. What was it like there?
Hi, Ezra. So Mariposa Grove is this beautiful stand of giant sequoias, these 300-foot tall, just enormous towering trees in this dense forest of green and brown. And you can walk through it. There's a gravel trail that makes about a half a mile loop through the whole thing, so you can meander and look up at these trees. There are viewing platforms. Everyone is just staring straight up, which is just so striking. This is Sue Beatty. She's a restoration ecologist with the park who has been working on the grove.
This is the largest grove of giant sequoias in Yosemite National Park. We have three groves.
And Ezra, she says these trees can live to be about 2,000 years old.
So you're surrounded by all these big trees and this new pathway and all that, but what did it look like before?
You used to be able to drive to the grove, park literally right there. So here's ecologist Sue Beatty again.
This used to be a parking lot.
So you could park right up against these sequoias.
Yeah, basically people were parking right on the sequoias.
There was this tram system that would weave right through the trees and through the grove. But Sue Beatty told me they got so close, the paint would actually rub off on the trees, which is pretty amazing. And so there were all sorts of problems up here. With all this asphalt, the road and the parking lot, the water wasn't getting to the roots. It was pretty noisy with all of these cars and car doors and everything. And so the whole area needed a change. Now you park at a brand new lot that's just inside Yosemite South Gate. It's a lot bigger than the old lot used to be, so it can actually handle more people than it could before. And right there at that new lot, there's a new visitor center and bus depot. And here, hybrid buses leave every 10 minutes or so to shuttle visitors to and from the grove. It's about a 2-mile drive. It takes just under 10 minutes, so it's pretty easy to get there and back on your own schedule. And it keeps visitors coming, but it puts distance between the grove and most of the human infrastructure that's there.
The park's created this distance between the giant sequoias and the people that visit this area. Why is that distance so important?
It's what's needed, or it's at least what ecologists believe was needed to really make sure that these trees do live on, you know, for this next 1,000 years or however long it could be.
On my last trip to Yosemite, I visited the Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias, and I got this like amazing feeling of peace and calm when I was standing right next to the sequoias. Carrie, how do they make you feel when you're right there in the grove?
I was overcome with serenity up there, and I think that that's really what dazzles visitors when they go up there as well. And I think that feeling is really nicely encapsulated by Sue Beatty.
It's just so enjoyable to wander through these trees, and it brings a feeling of awe to me, a kind of a sacred feeling that I'm at someplace really special.
That was a 2018 podcast episode from Yosemite Land. You can still subscribe to the podcast and listen to all the episodes. A new CAP Radio podcast series called Tahoe Land is coming in August. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Janet Fitch is a smart, popular, award-winning author whose books include White Oleander and Paint It Black, both of which were bestsellers and both became movies. Her new book, Chimes of a Lost Cathedral, is the follow-up to her historical fiction from 2017, The Revolution of Marina M. Janet will be in Sacramento this Friday, July 26th, for an event with Stories on Stage Sacramento and the community of writers at Squaw Valley. She and I talked about the character of Marina and these two books recently in Squaw Valley.
Well, Marina is pregnant by her great true love, who is a very difficult guy. She's broken up with him in a passion, and she sought her family's estate, which is back in the country. She goes there and discovers that her mother set up a cult there. And she is going to try to wait out her pregnancy there. But it proves absolutely intolerable. And so at the end of book one, we've have her pregnant and leaving in the dead of winter to go anywhere else, somewhere else. And she's completely on her own for the first time in her life.
We are in the year 1919 mm-hmm. in this new book. What is 1919 in Russia?
1919 is at the height of the Russian Civil War, the battle between the Reds, the Bolshevik forces, and the Whites, which were everybody who was not Bolshevik. Red Russia was shrunk to just the Central European part of Russia, with armies on all sides. Everybody was taking sides, and food scarcity was tremendous. Everything was in the balance.
Marina is married, but she's pregnant by someone else, mm-hmm. her true love. She moves from harrowing and dangerous adventure to another worse, more frightening adventure. In there is the story of the birth of her baby. Will you talk about all that she endures in the context of the way she was raised?
Well, she grew up a daughter of the intelligentsia. Her father was a lawyer. Her mother was an artistic type of person. They were very well off, part of Petersburg society. So she grew up with a nanny and a governess and maid and cook and the whole bit, but fell in love with a radical poet just as the revolution was breaking. And it was like stepping off one ice floe onto another, and she joined the life of the times. It was a coming of age, you know, as she's trying to figure out where she stands. I like characters who straddle worlds, who see both sides of things, a very kind of a stereoscopic view of events, and feeling the pull of the present against what she was raised with really raises her awareness of the changes. And by the time book two starts, she's already gone through that process. She has come of age. Now she's a woman. She has no one to depend on. No one is advising her. She is just taking her own measure of things. And it's a very difficult time. Luckily, she's a very passionate, courageous, adventurous person. And she is determined that she's going to survive and flourish and find herself and find her voice as an intellectual and as a poet and really, you know, have something to say about life in those times.
You mix real life characters with fictional characters, and you're a student of Russian history as well. So how did this story come to you?
My love of Russia came through Russian literature. So I saw her as a poet coming into herself. I didn't realize it was going to be about the revolution. I had the character, but I had her in the 20s living in Los Angeles, kind of the aftermath of the revolution. And every time I did the backstory, my writer's group was like, oh, no, that's the story we want to know. I majored in history. Russian history was my background. I wasn't unfamiliar with the time. And I thought, well, let's just do it. I have a motto. Dorothy Allison said that fiction never exceeds the writer's courage. And there are times that I really wondered, was I completely out of my mind doing this? Maybe I'm out of my mind, but I've come too far, and I'm not going to fall off the horse just because I'm afraid.
How many years?
12 for the two books.
There's no shortcut through a revolution, is there?
No. We're living in revolutionary
right.
times now.
Right.
I read a lot of memoirs in researching this book, and people were saying that every week was like a month. Every month was like a year. Their heads spun with how fast everything changed. So that's definitely a part of the book. But until these times, I had never experienced that myself. So as I was finishing the book, I'm like, oh my God, now I see what they were talking about.
There is a point, I would say 3/4 of the way through the book, when Marina's been through so much, and the whole cast of characters, which you lay out at the beginning, thankfully, have all endured and changed. And there's some reference to
it being almost 4 years now, and I thought, wait, what? This feels like 2 decades that these people have struggled and suffered. And I found myself, Janet, strange as it sounds, feeling very appreciative for bread, a bed, for a warm bath, that if you really get immersed in it, I think you take stock of where you are and what you have yourself.
I feel like I've lived through the revolution. Having lived through this revolution longer than the revolution took, you know, 12 years, I don't take the word lightly anymore. You know, what we're going through is a seizure, but revolution is something quite different. And especially the people who start a revolution are not necessarily the people who finish it. Things change a lot as it goes along. And people who end up with power are not necessarily the idealists who start things. It made me much more appreciative of the muddle through thing that democracy is, the imperfect, messy, overly talkative. Some people think revolution is just going to sweep everything clean and we can start again. But it's not like that. It's an apocalypse. I mean, it's a huge and unpredictable thing. And it made me appreciative of our democracy.
You are listening to Janet Fitch. Her best-selling books include White Oleander, Paint It Black. Both were made into movies. We are talking about the sequel to The Revolution of Marina M. The new book is titled Chimes of a Lost Cathedral. It seems like this book still has a grip on you. We are in 2019. The revolution was 1919. But how much is your head or some version of your whole sensory self still in it?
I'm slowly, slowly climbing out. I put an app on my phone, you know. I'm still signing checks 1919.
Wait, putting an app on your phone is a sign that you are in present
day.
Oh,
I'm trying to move back into, you know, our current moment. But yeah, I'm still very much in 1917, 1919, 1921.
Are you done with Marina for a while?
For a while, absolutely. You know, never say never. I don't know if I'll ever
get back there.
I would like to write in the present for a while, but, you know, she still has some tricks up her sleeve.
We are having this conversation in Squaw Valley, and in fact, we are in a home that for a while was a bit of a base for you while you were writing this book.
Yeah, it's high up in the Sierra at the home of Barbara and Oakley Hall, who were the founders of the Squaw Valley Community of Writers, and their daughter, Brett Hall Jones, is one of the administrators of the program, and she invited me to come and stay in her parents' house to work on this book because it was a massive project. And I came, it was early May, there was still snow everywhere, with my milk crates full of books. I mean, I traveled at the time with 30 reference books and then these giant ring binders, 7 ring binders that contained the novel. Work and stoke the stove. Oakley was a writer, and the place is full of signed first editions. And I felt so embraced by literature and by the mountains. Felt like I could be in Russia here. You know, in LA, it's very hard to be in 1919 Russia.
Would you read a passage that you would have worked on when you were up here in the Olympic Valley?
Yes, yeah, I got a chance to be really cold. So this is a chapter that begins, the temperature dropped down, down into the sarcophagus of negative numbers. Minus 30, minus 40, minus 50 degrees. On Shpilernaya Street, all the tenants dragged their mattresses into the front parlor, where we slept pressed together for warmth, pooling our wood, breathing each other's breaths, sharing each other's lice. When the wood was gone, we tore up the floorboards at the back of the apartment. A dying city eats itself alive, the way a starving body consumes its own flesh. Every day people died in the street, just dropped as they walked along or fell in the queues. Nothing could be done.
Janet Fitch, reading from Chimes from a Lost Cathedral. You did say that you carry binders along with you, not that you were writing this on a laptop?
I write on a laptop, but I always print out. I've certainly had computers die on me. I want to see it on the page. I don't like the ephemerality of writing on a computer. I may have terrible handwriting. I'm very grateful that there is such a thing as word processing, but I want to see the chapters. I want to see the alternation of day and night, interior and exterior, very introverted scenes with groups of people. And I can sense that much more clearly when they're in ring binders, how big scenes are, how big chapters are.
How big books are, Janet? The first book was over 800 pages, and I didn't realize when I read it there would be a book two, but it so clearly left everything hanging that I thought there better be a book two. This one is almost 800 pages. When it came to you, was it one story or was it two parts of one story?
It was a continuous story. Now that I've been working on it, knowing that it was going to be published in two volumes, I really started to see how it did fall into two parts emotionally for the character. The coming of age story, the revolution of Marina M., and then the story of a woman upon whom the blows have landed, and how do you form your life through that? How do you make moral decisions that are informed decisions, but very difficult ones? I felt that it was a kind of a different flavor, different color, as the second half of the revolution was very different than the first half. Much less about idealism and much more about power.
I love the second half of the story, the richness, the characters, the connection, so much movement, so much intensity that happened to everybody, and I felt really transported. What are you writing now?
Two short stories, one a noir crime story set in the desert in Palm
Springs.
You really
are shifting away from
and
the
one
moment.
A sci-fi.
Yeah.
An asteroid where they send the artists, get them off planet because they're troublemakers. And in Soviet Russia, there was a town called Peredelkino, which was a dacha town where a lot of the very famous writers lived. It was treated sort of as a privilege, which it was, but it was also they were too famous to kill. Pasternak, Akhmatova, these people lived at Peredelkino where they could keep an eye on them. They tormented their families, but they themselves were spared. Is it a prison or is it a writer's colony? That's a very interesting question. So I'm working on that, and I'm working on getting some ideas for a new book.
So ultimately, in all of the stories, even the new one you're just describing, I wonder whether you're trying to teach us or whether you're trying to make us wonder, to keep us curious and learning.
I don't think about that so much as just patches of conflict, of areas where I feel that on some deep level inside of me, where my obsessions and fascinations are, there are things that trouble me. What do you believe? What is the future? What is worth fighting for? What is not worth fighting for? What does it mean to be adult? What does it mean to have responsibilities and then also have challenges outside of those responsibilities? And how do they weigh against each other? I think that there's always the call of idealism and then against that, the practicalities of real life. And often idealism fails to take into account protecting those we love, being sensitive to kind of the tenor of real reality. The Bolsheviks were idealists, but people were sort of in the way. You know, they shove them around until they're in the right place or get rid of people, just, you know. Whereas Marina came to dislike the idea of looking at people from such a distance. You know, those are people's, these are our lives, you know. Does the end justify the means? That kind of question. These are the questions that I return to.
A PS to this is, what about writing poetry? These books have been full of a lot of poetry that I know to some degree has been translated from Russian original poetry and Russian books, but what about your own?
It's very funny. I find it much easier to write my characters' poetry than it is to write my poetry.
Wow.
Because I know where my characters are. I understand what they're thinking about, what is worrying them. I know what they've read, who they admire as poets. And so when I write their poetry, it speaks directly to what's going on with them. Hmm. For myself, you know, it's much more submerged. I don't know what's going on with me. I have written some poetry. I actually came up here to Squaw Valley when this book was done and gave myself a gift of the poetry week. I was a participant. It was fabulous. But it was much more difficult than writing my character's poetry.
So you need a character named Janet Fitch. And then you.
But who
poetry.
Is that? You know, our self, you know, the self is so evanescent. I could never write a memoir, for instance. I have absolutely no idea who I am. I'm a cloud of little charged particles and little experiences and little points of view. Just this cloud of information. It doesn't have a shape to it. I have no idea who Janet Fitch is.
That was Janet Fitch in a conversation recorded at the Hall House in Squaw Valley. She and I will continue the chat this Friday, July 26th, in a lovely evening of entertainment at Clara Auditorium. There is a link to more information on our website, capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Wayne Wallace is a 5-time Grammy nominee and an accomplished trombone player. His group, the Wayne Wallace Latin Jazz Quintet, just released a new record, The Rhythm of Invention. It received a 4-star review in Downbeat magazine. Wayne talked with Cap Radio Jazz Music Director Gary Vercelli ahead of Wayne's upcoming performance for Jazz Night at the Crocker Art Museum.
I am a child of the 60s. I experienced everything, the peace, love thing. A couple of people that went to my local church were Black Panthers. I saw the Grateful Dead and the Jefferson Airplane in some of their first performances out in Golden Gate Park by accident. Fillmore West and jazz clubs, Keystone Corner, Basin Street West, the Black Hawk, on and on. I was just born at the right time to catch some of those things in their upswing or their demise.
How did you get involved in both jazz and Latin music?
My elementary school, they offered music lessons to people and they help you get the instrument. And I said I wanted to play trombone and that started it all. The biggest influence was my parents had 2 Nat King Cole records and 2 Louis Jordan records. And that set the foundation for me, and I just kind of moved forward from there as far as jazz is concerned.
And then the salsa connection came later?
Yeah, it came much later. That came in the 80s, but in between there was this rhythm and blues phase where I was working with a lot of R&B people and worked with Nardo Michael Walden on Whitney Houston recordings, Earth, Wind & Fire, and Aretha Franklin. I worked with the great R&B band Confunction, things like that.
In the 1980s, I spent a lot of nights at Keystone Corner, but I always heard about this other club called Beijones. And then I read in some of your liner notes that some of your formative associations were made at Beijones. Take us back to that time and tell me, was it kind of a cooking pot of local talent?
Yes, it was. The Brazilian, jazz, salsa, Afro-Cuban scene all existed in that one club, and each genre would play on a separate night. And of course, we would go see each other play and sit in. A lot of the collaborations that happened were a direct result of Beijones existing simultaneously with Caesar's Latin Palace up the street from Juan Valencia, Celia Cruz, Tito Puente, Johnny Pacheco, Oscar de Leon, all those people. The New York bands would come.
In those days, people were dancing to music provided by live musicians.
Yes, they were. As strange as it may seem to this day, yes, they were.
But things have transitioned quite a bit. Tell me about the scene here in San Francisco now. There seems to be a lack of energy or clubs the way there was in the 80s, from my perspective.
I agree, and I try to be pragmatic about it. And with the advent of or the sprint to technology now, that part, we're in conflict as artists. You can either embrace the technology, fight it, or find the middle ground. You can't get away from it. And you have to think about more than gigs because there aren't enough clubs. I've been telling my students the last 3 or 4 years, you have to get grants, you have to perform at public libraries, you have to do commissions, you have the internet where you can do things with YouTube or whatever. But you have to promote yourself in a variety of ways. Those days, unless something radically changes, those days are gone. What is that, the Steely Dan tune? Those days are gone forever, over a long time ago, that one lyric. Every generation changes. People were sad with what happened after the 1940s, after bebop ended, and it moved into the 50s with rock and roll. And then there was complaints about the Beatles when they came along. On and on and on. Disco, take your pick. So you just, if you're an artist, you just adjust.
I'm Gary Vercelli. We're on Insight with Wayne Wallace. And Wayne, I want to talk about your latest album. There's a Eddie Palmieri composition, Vamonos Palmonte. Eddie's always been famous for his use of trombones in the band. Is that part of the appeal for including that composition?
Yep. Eddie's been a great influence. I have a lot of reverence that he took chances. He not only played jazz music, he played dance music. He wasn't afraid to take chances. He was one of those artists that set the edge.
Did a wonderful arrangement of Take Five from one of the best-selling albums of all time.
Yep.
What did you do with such a complex time signature to take it into the Latin realm?
Well, that's a funny story. I found this recording of Tito doing Take Five, but he did it in 4/4. And I went, oh, well, Tito did that because he was playing for dancers. He wanted to make sure they could dance to it. And I went, well, I guess I want to try to do it in five. Instead of a clave pattern, we synthesized a 5/4 pattern for the main body of the song. The other thing I thought, just to make it a little different, on the original Dave Brubeck recording, nobody solos on the bridge. I wanted to make sure we actually use the chord changes, and Mary Fedick plays a brilliant solo through that. It's just I didn't want to disrespect the original intent of the song because its genius is in its simplicity. So I just wanted to add things to it, but not take away from what Paul Desmond and Dave Brubeck had done on the song.
I want to ask you about a couple of your own original compositions. There's a cha-cha-cha called Playa Negra.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
I was inspired. I went to Costa Rica, and there's a beach there called Playa Negra. That part of Costa Rica, there's a space there called Limon, L-I-M-O-N. And I went and sat in with a band there. They played Cuban salsa, reggae, soul music from Gamble and Huff, like Teddy Pendergrass, and everything in between. And I just went, I've met the musical nexus of the Caribbean. And I just went, okay, so it's a black beach, etc., Playa Negra. I went, okay, that'll work.
Talk about education these days. There's the Berklee College of Music. There's where you teach. In Sacramento, we've got a lot of really good high school programs. I think the missing element, from my perspective, is the kids are getting a good education, but they're not getting that interaction like when you were playing in salsa clubs and really kind of seeing what your music does to people dancing.
I have an ongoing saying, the best thing that ever happened to jazz is jazz education, and the worst thing that ever happened to jazz is jazz education. It's so difficult to take an organic process and then try to write it down and teach it a certain way. The Coltranes, the Parkers, the Gillespies, take your pick, found their voices by actively playing and exploring. And that's the challenge we're having now as educators, is to keep that intact, but put it in a form so it works within the academic setting. And I actively talk to my students as take everything you need here, whether it's the vocabulary, the experience, and the mentorship, but find your own voice.
You're a man who appreciates the space between notes, I think.
Yes, I do.
And so many times I get an album from a young, promising musician, and it sounds like they're trying to play everything they know and put it on display. But they need to take a breath, I think, right?
You know what? You can listen to people talk like that on television. I mean, usually your instrument is an extension of your voice. And if you think about Ben Webster, the older players, and there's another good story about that. It's Dexter Gordon. Somebody asked him to play a tune, and he thought for a second, I can't play that song. I don't know the lyrics to it. I think that says it all. There's a lot of tunes where people know the heads, but they don't know the lyrics, and they can't really tell the story. As a soloist in the 40s, if you couldn't do that, you didn't work. That's what they didn't like about the beboppers. They weren't telling stories. That was a clash between the swing musicians and the Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, even though they had grown up on that tradition. You know the story, like Charlie Parker getting gonged and stuff at those jam sessions, because he was experimenting. So old school versus new school, how do we move forward? How is it accepted and not accepted? it's an ongoing thing. But to answer your question about jazz academia, there's more jazz schools now giving out degrees than when I started by 100, 200 times. And God bless them. I mean, it keeps the genre happening, but sure is a tough struggle with the lack of clubs to play at and actually get that visceral experience and feedback from an audience. And that's the other thing. I really believe there's a synergy between the audience and the performers that is a circle where they become one. And you look at what Cuban musicians have done. The times I went to Cuba, that was the epitome of it. The audience would make a dance move, the band would react to the dance move, the arranger would look at how the dancers were dancing, create a new rhythm or a different phrasing in a song to work with the dancers. It's this ongoing game. And I've been carrying that with me all along.
Trombonist and band leader Wayne Wallace with Cap Radio's Gary Vercelli earlier this month. The new album by the Wayne Wallace Latin Jazz Quintet is The Rhythm of Invention. He will perform at the Crocker Art Museum for Jazz Night on Thursday, July 25th, and we have ticket information at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Insight is produced by Cody Drabble and Kate Gonzalez. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. We had help from Helen Barrington and Antonio Munez. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.